from Relay. This is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of television. This is episode number 83, recorded November the 26th, 2024. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell. And with me this time, so glad to have her here, it's Natalie Jarvie, who has covered the industry at such places as Business Insider, Vanity Fair, and The Hollywood Reporter, where I used to talk to her regularly for the old Download podcast. Natalie, welcome to Downstream.
Jason, it's so nice to be reconnected.
It's so great. I'm glad you could do this. You had a lot going on in your life, but I'm glad we finally made it work. We could have you on this special Thanksgiving week episode.
Well, I've been watching a lot of TV and thinking a lot about streaming, so I'm ready to talk all about what's going on in the world.
Nice. I wanted to start with Apple, which I know, I mean, I talk about Apple a lot. That's my main job. But this is a really interesting case where John Watts, the director and writer of Wolfs, the movie with George Clooney and Brad Pitt, came out and just said in a statement to Deadline that that the whole thing about Apple asking for a sequel to Wolfs was something that he told them not to say because he was going to refuse to do it. And the money quote is, "I no longer trusted them as a creative partner." Ouch.
Yeah,
this goes back to the kind of week before release announcement, or he got a week's notice that they were going to announce they weren't going to do a theatrical release, which is obviously one of the big themes of movies on streaming is, do they get a theatrical release? Is it a big one? Is it just for awards? Is it just to make the talent happy? And in this case, they said they would. Then they said, never mind. And used the sequel script order as a way to sort of save face and like, no, we like the movie, so that they could launch it and make it not seem like they thought it was a stinker, even though John Watts was like, no, don't do that, which is, I mean, movies and streaming is a weird mixture anyway, but this is, I feel like, I mean, from a talent standpoint, this is not how you handle talent in the business, what Apple did here. And also, I do think it sort of points out just what a mess Apple's movie strategy is, and kind of streamer's movie strategy is. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the big gamble when you work with a streamer. They, you know, may say they want to go theatrical, but at the end of the day, like, that's not their business model. And it's, you know, it's not that surprising that they will make changes and adjustments. And, you know, Amazon did something very similar a few years ago. So, you know, that is the risk you take if you sign a big deal with a place like Apple, as opposed to going to a Universal or a Warner Brothers, which is fully committed to theatrical.
Right. Less, I think less of a betrayal, too, than what happened at Warner Brothers, where Jason Kilar, you know, pulled everything onto Max, because that was during COVID. And like, It was a different sort of situation. This is that's what I've been telling people about. This is like, as a business decision, I kind of understand it. I kind of understand Apple being like, no, we should not put this in theatrical. It's not going to do well. Let's just not even bother. It's just going to cost us money. But, you know, you make a great point, which is, I know that actors and directors and writers want to be in theaters. I totally get it. But taking streamer money kind of does imply, doesn't it, that they're not going to be particularly committed. And unless they're contractually committed, they're really not committed to putting it in a movie theater. It's not what they're there for.
Absolutely. I mean, and it doesn't mean that theatrical is not important to these creatives. I think we've seen time and again, especially since that COVID era experiment of putting a lot of movies on streaming, that theatrical is actually the best way to launch a big feature film. You know, that the marketing budget that you can associate with putting a film in theaters really can help drive awareness, and that actually the trickle down effect of when then that project gets to streaming helps, that if it's been in theaters and been marketed as a theatrical movie, that more people will watch it on streaming as a result. So I totally understand creatives wanting that and desiring that. In this case, it doesn't feel so much to me as a reflection on Wolfs as it is a reflection on, to your point earlier, Apple's kind of confused movie strategy. I mean, they've had a few misses recently in theatrical releases. Not long before Wolfs, they had Fly Me to the Moon, which Sony helped them distribute. it only grossed $40 million worldwide. And it had Scarlett Johansson and Channing Tatum. Yeah. So, you know, I think that they probably looked at that performance and the performance of some other projects prior to that, like Argylle, which was this big spy thriller that didn't do as well as planned, and said, well, wait a second, you know, maybe it's George Clooney and it's Brad Pitt, but maybe there's not an audience here for this kind of movie, and it actually is better suited on our streaming platform instead. So that's my hunch as to kind of what happened here.
Yeah, they seem to be retrenching and recalibrating their strategy, which I think they should do for the reasons that you just elaborated, that they seem to have spent a lot of money on things with not as much return. And it sounds like they're going to change what they do. They're going to have, you know, some tent poles, but also a lot of kind of smaller movies, and that it's a better mix. I love your point about marketing, and something that Julia and I talked about for the last couple of years, which is movie marketing does have this incredible follow-on effect because it makes people know what the movie is. And then when it's on your service, there's like, oh, I want to see that movie. That is pretty valuable. Is part of the problem that movies and streaming services, because they're one-shot deals, is it just a more awkward fit? They're very expensive, but they're a one-shot. And I wonder sometimes if the perfect thing for the streaming era really is a series or miniseries rather than a single-shot movie. Is there a right way and a wrong way to do movies in the streaming era, or do we just not know yet?
I think you're hitting on something really smart there, that you're right. I mean, when you've got a series, even if you do the Netflix model and you release it as a binge drop, people probably aren't going to sit down and watch the whole thing in one night. So you get a few days out of them. You know, you at least milk a little bit of, viewing hours out of them over the course of a day or several days or several weeks, depending. But on top of that, you also get the library, and that, you know, asset lives on the streaming service. People can go find it whenever they want and watch 5, 10, you know, 20 hours, depending on what the project is. Whereas with a movie, you're lucky if you get 2, maybe 3 hours. And not everyone is the kind of person who goes back and rewatches a movie over and over and over again. So you're right that it's kind of this one shot and then it's gone. I do think that there are movies that are, you know, lower budget, the kind of rom-coms and, you know, kind of adult dramas that are
in Hallmark season, right, too. I mean, stuff like that makes sense. Totally. Like, yeah, Hallmark movies and other stuff like that. Yeah,
exactly. Those are the kinds of movies that I think do really well on streaming and make a lot of sense. I also think if you can get yourself into a franchise of sorts, it's not some, you know, big, crazy Zack Snyder new universe that is going to cost a lot of money, but something where you can, you know, at least get a couple sequels out of it, that can be compelling, too. But otherwise, it's really hard, I think, to get the same kind of long tail out of movies, original movies, as you can out of original TV shows.
Yeah, and the stigma is fading. I guess if you're Brad Pitt and George Clooney, you have this thought of like, well, we're movie stars and we're making a movie. And I get it. But there are lots of great movie stars who make HBO series, they make Netflix series, they make Apple TV series. So even that is fading away. And I wonder sometimes if you're a writer, director, or actor, if you like the idea of having a little more time, spreading that budget over more hours, which might give you more performance, and it might be, it's not a movie anymore, but it might, I wonder if there might even be some creative fulfillment. I know that Gary Oldman has said that he is delighted by doing Jackson Lamb in Slow Horses. And one of the reasons that it delights him is he's never really worked in TV before. And so he's never really had a character who evolves from season to season, because whether it's on stage or in a movie, you just have your one through line and then the movie is over. And I thought that was really interesting because Gary Oldman, it's Gary Oldman. He's not some random, what we would think of as a random TV actor. Like, he's a star. He's an Academy Award fixture, and he makes that show. And that's not even a miniseries. That's literally just, it's a TV show, and seems to love it. So I wonder if over time, any remaining stigma will drop away and creative people might actually look at the idea of doing a 4 or 6 or 8 hour series or miniseries as a, as a perfectly fine trade-off for something like a movie that might even take a similar amount of time to produce, right? Because a lot of movie production is much slower than the pace of TV. I don't know. I'm not an actor. I'm not a Hollywood screenwriter, but I do wonder if maybe that it's all just kind of fading away, other than like your big blockbuster tentpoles or some very specific short stories that you want to tell in movie form.
Yeah, well, let me just say, for starters, Gary Oldman delights me in Slow Horses, so I'm thrilled so that he wants to play that character forever. And I think that stigma has largely gone away. I mean, look, Nicole Kidman is making many TV shows a year in some instances.
Yeah.
You know, someone like Brad Pitt is the rare holdout who, you know, hasn't really dipped right. their toes in that water. You know, Leonardo DiCaprio is another example. You know, but it's interesting that, you know, Brad and George are getting comfortable with streaming movies. George also had The Boys in the Boat for Amazon recently. So, you know, and Brad is also doing a Formula One movie for Apple.
Apple next year, yeah.
You know, I do think that as the industry is contracting and opportunities are getting smaller and fewer movies are getting made, big stars are going to start saying, okay, well, if my option is to do a streaming movie, that might be my option. Now, I think they also then have some leverage to try to get those movies into theaters in many cases. But to your point about kind of that, you know, difference between movies and TV on streaming, I think Alfonso Cuarón's Disclaimer, which was recently on Apple TV Plus, is a really interesting example of that. It essentially felt like an 8 or 6 hour, I don't remember how long it was, movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, it had some flaws, but it was interesting to see a filmmaker like him, you know, kind of apply his movie sensibilities to a TV show. And, you know, I don't know that always works, ultimately.
Right.
So, you know, maybe some lessons there for, you know, what works in TV and what works in film.
Yeah, I mean, they are different, right? But like the novel adaptations, I think often will work better in TV because a novel has so much story that you have to omit, whereas movies feel more like short stories to me. I know Alan Sepinwall, the TV critic, has talked a lot about how a season of TV is not an 8 hour long movie, and that if you do that, you're sort of making a mistake. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting to see how the art form, you know, especially very talented directors who have been working in film forever, trying to think about what does a TV series look like and how is it paced differently. And I know if you look at like Steven Spielberg and the various miniseries that he's done, especially the ones with producing with Tom Hanks, like the all the World War II stuff, like those are episodic in a way. They're like little movies inside a framework instead of it being a single story. And there are lots of different ways to tell stories, but I am fascinated by seeing how the art changes, maybe pushed a little bit. Like, I wonder if there are some people, I'm sure there are some people out there who say, you know what, I know what a movie is, but if I'm going to go to Netflix or Amazon or Apple or wherever, and they're going to give me a 6 hour order or an 8 hour order, I'm not going to do a movie. It's like, I'm going to try something a little different. Isn't this interesting? Why don't I try this other to tell the story a little bit differently? And we'll see, you know, we'll learn what works and what doesn't. But I think that's really interesting. I was going to throw out, speaking of Apple TV actors, it tickles me that Harrison Ford is in a sitcom. Is it an ensemble sitcom? Because as a great movie star, one of our great all-time movie stars, like he is so frequently an action star who you know, he bursts his own bubble, and that's one of the magics of Harrison Ford, is Indiana Jones is always bleeding and beat up. But like to see him in a comedy doing mostly comedy with an ensemble, it's like I feel so lucky that we get to see Harrison Ford doing that this late in his career, because he's really good at it. And there was a time where like Harrison Ford's not going to be on a sitcom, but now all the rules are gone. It's like, sure, Harrison Ford can be a supporting character on a Jason Segel sitcom. It's fine. It's weird, but I like it.
It's, you know, it seems like he's choosing the projects he wants to do at this point in his career. It doesn't have to do much at all, I don't think. There must have been something about that resonated with him. And it is, you know, it is fun to get to see him on screen. It's much the same way, like Meryl Streep is now just a, you know, frequent recurring character on Only Murders in the Building. Like,
right?
What a joy. You know, Olivia Colman showed up in the Bear for a few mm-hmm. episodes. Like, it's so fun to see these people that you love watching on the big screen get to experiment with something a little bit different.
I agree. Before we get off this topic, I wanted to say one thing that I wanted to underscore is I like the business move here by Apple. I think that they probably made it for good reasons, and I know that they're changing their direction. You can overstate what a bad Hollywood move this is, because there are, you know, every studio has bad things that it does and people get over it. Usually money is involved and they get over it. But I do think that that a lot of these primarily tech company, non-traditional streamers, there's some suspicion there. It's like, we'll take your money, but we don't know if we trust you. And I think that I just wanted to note, like, I think only giving John Watts a week's notice is not great. Refusing or ignoring his request to not have his sequel mentioned as part of their PR cover is really problematic. Now, I've seen a report that says that somebody told someone in his representation maybe about this, but like, he's obviously really put out. And it's just one of those things that feels like an own goal. And like, when you're Apple and you're trying to say, no, we do understand you. We're not just a computer company. Stories like this can take on a life of their own. And it's something that they're going to have to live down. And it's probably going to cost them financially, because the next person they approach is going to hold out for that much more Apple money, more iPhone money in order to do the project. So I think they kind of blew it there, even though I understand like why they did what they did. I think they probably should have done it in a different way.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, this isn't a mistake that you could have excused when Apple was first getting into the business, but they've been doing this for a long time now, and they have a couple of seasoned Sony executives running the show. So, you know, something broke down and didn't happen the way it should have there. And listen, you know, other studios have been guilty of doing similar things. Who can forget, you know, Disney and the Scarlett Johansson Black Widow debacle of the pandemic, you know? So even places known for having these, you know, really great relationships with creatives have missteps every now and then and handle things improperly. And but Apple has been in the game long enough now that they probably could have avoided having John, you know, speak out negatively about this partnership.
That really hurts, because he's been really bothered by it. All right, let's move on to some other news. Comcast has announced what they had threatened, and I've talked about it on this podcast before. They are going to spin off all of their cable channels, except for Bravo, interesting choice, to a new company that doesn't have a name yet, and it will be run by some existing Comcast, NBC Universal executives, but MSNBC, CNBC, USA, Sci-Fi, and the rest, except Bravo, are going to be put out on the ice floe and allowed to drift away into the cold ocean. Because linear cable channels, very profitable to this day, they're still very profitable, but everybody knows that that is only going to go down, not up. And so they're sort of loading up their assets, and there's a question about whether everybody else is going to do that, or whether this company might even start buying linear cable companies from the other giants. They'll all put all of their elders onto the same bit of ice. I don't know. Not to be too morbid, but I mean, that's kind of what it is like, you know, we want to be unburdened from linear cable. So we're just going to like make another company and don't look over there. Look over here where we're the future. It's, you know, I think any of us who have covered this transition in the industry knew this day was coming, but this feels meaningful in a way to say the big companies are now just going to start walking away from their linear cable channels. It's not over, but the game is ending.
Yeah, I mean, this would be like if Netflix had spun off its DVD business, right? And prioritized streaming, whereas instead they just kind of, you know, acted like it didn't really exist anymore.
They tried to spin it off and it didn't work. And they're like, never
sure
mind.
Did. But yeah. And, you know, many companies have telegraphed moves like this in the last couple of years. I mean, Comcast not that long ago signaled that they were interested in potentially offloading these assets. You know, Disney, Bob Iger, after he returned to the company, you know, floated some kind of similar scenarios that he ultimately didn't pull the trigger on. So it's kind of fun and exciting to see Comcast try it and see what happens. And you know, if it's successful, you may see others try something similar. So it's certainly, you know, a big move to watch. Hmm.
Yeah, I obviously one of the questions is going to be what happens with the news division. And I think nobody has an answer, but it's fascinating to think like all the ties that are all the synergies, right? That everybody says, oh, well, the reason we're an entertainment behemoth is because we have synergies all the way. Like we have our broadcast channels and our linear cable channels, and we put the negotiations together so that if you want our broadcast channel, you need to take our cable channels as well. Well, that's kind of a broken thing now. And then also literally NBC has used NBC News as the source of content for MSNBC and CNBC as well. So, and they've used their other linear cable in the past as like overflow for the Olympics. Although again, there's Peacock now, so it's not really as necessary, but I do wonder what happens, you know, unraveling this is going to be a little messy and there are going to be some weird things that go on because MSNBC, like right now, it is not just a political talk network, but they also are an arm of NBC News and, you know, similar with business information and CNBC. And it feels like that, you know, they're going to either need to do some sort of very weird licensing agreement or some other contract in terms of content being provided, or they're going to end up having to sort of pull staff out of NBC News and have them go out with the spun out channels. It's just, it's going to be a real challenge for all of these companies to unravel all of these connections that were beneficial 15 years ago or 20 years ago, but aren't beneficial anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be messy for a while. I mean, I saw a joke of, you know, what's MSNBC without NBC? Well, it's just MS.
MS.
Yeah, you know, is CNBC without the NBC is just C, you know? These are probably going to be renamed eventually, which is always a challenge. I also think about this from the streaming perspective, which is that, you know, all these streaming services that launched a few years ago, the idea was trying to be as many things to as many people as possible. And so you got, you know, Disney Plus stuffed full of programming and HBO Max, now Max, stuffed full of programming, and Peacock, same thing. You could, you know, add all of the programming from all of these various cable channels and, you know, have this real robust product that, you know, the thinking was this could stand up against Netflix and be a real competitor. And so this seems to be a bit of a retrenchment in that strategy. And, you know, to your point, there are some possibilities for some licensing agreements. I wouldn't be surprised if we continued to see some of this content live on Peacock as the kind of streaming home without Peacock having to be a, you know, a true corporate sister to those, you know, networks and NBC owning all that content. But, you know, it's definitely a change in thinking about what Peacock is and what it can be for subscribers.
I'm also fascinated that they want to keep Bravo. I think that's really interesting that they're like, yeah, you can't have Bravo. We're not going to let you have Bravo. I don't know. Would you have any thoughts about why Bravo of all of them?
Yeah, anecdotally, I know a lot of people who subscribe to Peacock purely for the Bravo content. Housewives,
yeah,
all those franchises are a huge draw. And, you know, there are some people who go to Peacock for the sports, some people who go for, you know, the originals. But I think there's a lot of people who go there for the Bravo content. So that one felt probably just a little too lucrative to give up. And it's also so kind of synonymous with the NBC brand now. It's also, if you look at this, you know, portfolio of cable channels, I couldn't tell you a single original show on Sci-Fi these days. You know,
yeah, it's not what it was. USA Sci-Fi used to generate a huge amount of original content, and Bravo is still generating originals in a way that so many of these, I was going to say they're hollowed out. It's that thing where they have just, it's not what you remember, where there was like a slate of originals. It really is just sort of like 8 hours of one show rerunning, and then the next day it's 8 hours of some other show, and that's about it. And so it's not, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of value there in terms of especially original content that's going to get people. It's kind of reruns, which makes, I mean, there's value in having a stream of reruns if you're a linear TV subscriber, I suppose. But yeah, strategically for Peacock, having the Bravo content still be in family makes sense to me.
Exactly.
All right, let me take a break and tell you about our sponsor. This episode of Downstream is brought to you by Tract, your streaming sidekick. Tracked is like having a super smart friend who knows everything about what you're watching. It's ideal for those times when you're thinking, what should I watch next? There is so much to love about Tracked. Streaming Scrobbler is a great feature launching next week. It automatically tracks what you're watching on Netflix, Hulu, Prime Video, and more. Going forward, no need to manually log anything. Just sit back and enjoy. Their global streaming guide tells you exactly where to find your favorite shows and movies, no matter where you are in the world, and you keep your must-watch list organized and at your fingertips on your watch list. No more scrolling endlessly through streaming services. And the year in review, we're getting to the end of the year. What better time? Dive into your viewing stats and discover fun facts about your watching habits. It's like a personal version of Netflix Wrapped, but for all of your services. Really like Tracked. Great way to keep track of what we're watching, what we've watched. I really like just forgetting what shows we've got active and what shows we've got planned. You read about a show and you're like, I want to watch this, but I have too much else going on right now. I'm going to save it. And then you get to the end of the other show and you're like, now what? And you've forgotten what it is. Tracked, put it down in there. You'll remember. It'll remember for you. And then you can pick it up. The best part, Tracked is available in so many places on the web. In Android, iOS, now even on Apple TV, it is your pocket-sized TV guru, always ready to make your streaming life easier and more fun. And that Streaming Scrobbler is going to be awesome. Go to tracked.tv/downstream, and you'll get 50% off of Tracked VIP. That's TRAKT.tv/downstream for a 50% discount on VIP. Again, that's tracked.tv/downstream for a 50% discount for the first year. Thank you to Tracked for supporting Downstream. So, okay, I have a, like Joe Adalian, you can cover yours or participate as much as you want, but I want to give people an update about the Diamond bankruptcy, because as we recorded, literally between recording and editing the last time episode with Will Carroll, Diamond made a deal with MLB and emerged from, or set the stage to emerge from, bankruptcy. So this is the owner of all the regional sports networks that used to be Bally Sportsnet. Originally, they were Fox Sportsnet. They are becoming FanDuel. They were run by Sinclair, which is a chain of local stations. They hemorrhaged money, filed for bankruptcy, and then jousted with the NHL, the NBA, and Major League Baseball about what they were willing to pay their creditors on their way out of bankruptcy. And so that all happened right after we recorded the last episode. So just as an update, more than anything else, Major League Baseball and Diamond did come to terms. Diamond was cleared to emerge from bankruptcy. They are sticking with 6 different Major League teams. They have multi-year deals with Atlanta, Miami, the LA Angels, St. Louis, and Detroit. And they have also introduced a new paper game option, which is kind of quirky and fun, which is like, if you want to watch a game that's an NBA or NHL game from one of their services, you actually don't even need to subscribe to a monthly or season-long plan. You can spend, I think it's $7, and just get tonight's NHL game, tonight's NBA game, which is an interesting experiment, and that they're really kind of vlogging streaming as a big part of their future, that they have the part of their plan here is that they have streaming rights for the teams that they have linear rights to, so that they can build packages around you watching those games as on streaming if you are a cord cutter. So they did it. Obviously, Major League Baseball is still out there planning what they're going to do next and how they want to build a bunch of national TV packages. I mentioned this with Will last time. It's unclear what form that's going to take, what teams are going to be in it. I think we will have plenty of time over the next year on this podcast to talk about what they might be up to there. But it sounds that at least for now, the Diamond MLB thing is resolved. They won't have as many teams as they used to. A bunch of them, I think half of them, are gone from their air now before versus when they started this process. But they've kind of come out of that. So if you're a fan of one of those 6 teams, there will be a cable channel. It will be called FanDuel, and it will be what Bally's used to be, and you will get your games there, or you can get them via streaming if you don't want to subscribe to cable. So that's my update. I do think, Natalie, that one of the big impacts in this whole transition is how sports is being broadcast, and we're still trying to figure out how that's going to go. It feels like it's going to be cataclysmic, but it's only just now, I think, starting to happen and will happen over the next decade.
Absolutely. I mean, I was just thinking about how, you know, really it's the same market forces at play here with Diamond as with Comcast and its cable channels. You know, it's these companies trying to figure out a go forward strategy in the age of declining, you know, cable subscriptions. And, you know, we talk a lot about how sports is one of those things that can still drive live viewership. But when you have a lot of, you know, kind of rights to a lot of small regional teams, and there's a lot of MLB games, and it's all on, you know, these cable channels, it starts to, you know, be a lot harder to make the case that someone needs to, you know, add this to their, you know, already expensive cable subscription. So the fact that MLB is looking at, you know, more of these like larger national rights packages makes a lot of sense, especially, you know, as we look at, you know, how successful the NBA was in their recent negotiations.
Right, right. It helps to have the powerful national package. Fans who think, oh, this is going to be great, I'm going to pay one fee and get all my games, though, I'm going to keep on repeating this, which is that's not probably what it's going to be. You're also probably going to have some games that you have to see on someone's streaming service who paid Major League Baseball a lot of money, and that's just going to be part of it. But they need to, you know, try to replace some of that revenue that is no longer coming from cable companies. So it's got to come from somewhere else. Speaking of sports, by the way, before we let sports go by completely, I mean, I use the term loosely, honestly, when it comes to, I heard Matt Bellany on The Town this week referred to this as 65 million people watched an old man get beat up. But I mean, the Jake Paul, Mike Tyson fight, which I don't think we even talked about last time on this podcast, but Netflix says 65 million people watched it. And I guess, behold the power of Netflix, right? Netflix is a worldwide phenomenon. Lots of people have it. They haven't really done a live event quite like this one yet. They have an NFL game. They have two NFL games coming at Christmas time, but this is a huge number. This is a not quite a Super Bowl number, but it is a very, very large number for a sporting event. And you know, there were some technical issues. We got a letter from listener Michael, I assume that's not Mike Tyson, asking about the Netflix technical issues and wondering if they are better equipped to handle sporting events in the future, because as Michael points out, they're going to have these NFL games and they're going to have WWE I think next year. But that's a big number. Like I would say your average NFL game or WWE is probably not going to necessarily hit that number, although who knows? And I'm sure that they're working on it. But for a novelty event that like their whatever hot dog eating contest and the other stuff that they've done and the Tom Brady roast, right? Like for a novelty event of a YouTuber beating up an old man, 65 million. I mean, it's kind of an amazing number, isn't it?
It's a huge number. And, you know, I would push back that I think those NFL Christmas games could be large. They're novelties in their own way because it's the first time Netflix is ever doing it. They've just announced Beyonce as the halftime entertainment for
what
one
a moment,
of them.
Yeah.
You know, that's starting to sound like almost a Super Bowl, you know, unto itself, right. You know. So I think that there will be huge demand for those games. And, you know, I think anytime Netflix does something like this, you know, people are going to watch because there's a curiosity factor with Netflix trying something new and dipping into a new area that they haven't, you know, really gone into before. In terms of the, you know, question about can they do it, I it's interesting. I want to remind everyone just how challenging it is to stream concurrent streams and live stream. I mean, it was not that many years ago that HBO's you know, a streaming app, the predecessor to Max, would crash when people were watching Game of Thrones, the premiere, the finale, big episodes. I know that happened to me multiple times. You know, that's one of the reasons that the Major League Baseball's BAMTech technology that they ultimately sold to Disney was so valuable, is because they had powered a lot of streaming for a lot of companies and had perfected it in a way that few companies had been able to do on their own. And so they were able to license that technology and build this valuable business. So it's not easy. And it's not a surprise that it's, you know, taking Netflix some time to figure it out. And I think that's exactly why they're doing things like this right. Jake Paul, Mike Tyson fight, is they're testing. They're figuring out what works, what doesn't, where they need to patch holes, and how to improve so that when it matters the most, when, you know, a relationship with the NFL is on the line, they get it right. So, you know, we'll see what happens on Christmas Day. But, you know, I think I would guess they learned a lot from this fight and are, you know, hard at work figuring out how to, you know, increase their capacity in time for something even bigger.
For people who don't know, the difference between Game of Thrones and something like a live event is that there are these content distribution networks, CDNs, and what they do is for pre-recorded stuff, they preload that data onto these different servers that are sitting in your internet provider's server closet, and they're doing that all over the world. And so when everybody is watching that new episode of like Game of Thrones back in the day, they're not just hitting one server, right? They're hitting a giant distribution network of servers that have the content already on it. The problem with live is you can't do that. And so there are a lot of, so Netflix is great at distributing video all over the world. But when it's live, when it's the fight, when it's John Mulaney doing his talk show, whatever it is, it's a new challenge for Netflix. But I would never bet against Netflix being able to meet a technical challenge, right? Like it's going to be fine. They're going to figure it out.
There's some of the best in the business at this. And, yeah. You know, the user experience is the most important thing to them. Their whole business model is, you know, built off the idea of making it easier for people to watch TV. You don't like having to wait a week between episodes? Great. We'll give you the binge. You know, You want to be able to cancel whenever you want? Great. You know, you can subscribe monthly. All of those things are so important to them. And, you know, they're, you know, going to do everything they can to get this right and, you know, make sure that they deliver the best possible experience.
Yeah. I think the other thing that that 65 million number says to me, and I've heard a lot of anecdotes about it, and I wonder about the NFL as well and what they're doing with WWE, is the cultural cachet of Netflix, the fact that Netflix is number one when it comes to streaming, the fact that it's got a demographic that includes a lot of younger people who've really grown up where Netflix is television. And, they can't imagine my kids, like my daughter, like Netflix. I mostly keep Netflix for her because I know how much she uses it. And, you know, I do occasionally watch things. We just watched The Diplomat on Netflix, which was great. But it is TV for a certain generation, and it has huge amounts of penetration, and it's global. And you put all those things together, and things get, I think, pretty interesting, where people who might not find out how to navigate to get to a sporting event, a live event of some kind, because it's Netflix that's doing it, suddenly you get this broadcast-like, except worldwide, phenomenon where everybody's like, oh yeah, it's on Netflix, so I'll watch it, and that's the power of Netflix. And you put as an American, but you put Netflix and the NFL together, and it's just like, whoa, we'll see what Christmas is like. But like, if you think everybody's got Netflix, and also worldwide people have Netflix, it's going to be really interesting to see, because they I think that's why the sports industry is really interested in how this all goes with Netflix, because they are potentially a really incredibly powerful multiplier for their product if they get it right and if it all makes sense. It's going to be really interesting to watch it.
Absolutely. I mean, Netflix is amazing at creating the fervor around or feeling of something being a hit, whether or not the numbers actually, you know, quantify something as a hit. They know how to make it seem like everyone is watching and talking about something. And clearly 65 million is a huge number. A lot of people tuned in for that fight. Anecdotally, we did not plan to watch that in my household, and then started seeing all of the talk and social chatter about it. And said, okay, well, you should tune in and check out what's going on here, you know? And I can't remember the last time that happened around a major live event. I mean, of course, there's always the Oscars or the Super Bowl or these big things, but those are kind of appointment viewing if you, you know, are someone like me who loves movies and entertainment and sports. This was something I just didn't think I was going to care about until suddenly everyone else in my world seemed to be caring about it. So I thought, hey, I should check this out too.
Power of Netflix. I really think it is. Very interesting. Okay, so it is Thanksgiving week as we record this. I was asking you before the show in the run-up if there was something you wanted to talk about. And you mentioned talking about what this is, the sort of like Thanksgiving and post-Thanksgiving period and holiday television and what it is and maybe what it's going to be going forward. Let me know. So what were you thinking about here?
Well, speaking of the power of Netflix, you know, I have this kind of memory of as Netflix started to release original programming, that this time of year was always this really exciting time where people started to maybe take a little time off from work, have a little more time to watch TV. And it seemed like overnight there would be these like massive hits that would just show up on Netflix and suddenly everyone would be talking about them. And so I went and did a little research on what those things would have been. Making a Murder came out in this kind of corridor. The first season of The Crown and then subsequent seasons of The Crown kind of always debuted during this time of year. The Gilmore Girls reboot. Mm. The Queen's Gambit came out at the end of October, but I feel like that was a kind of a slow burn that really picked up around the holidays as people started to figure out that it was a show worth watching. The first season of Bridgerton, you know, these are all, you know, shows that kind of Netflix was really smart about programming, not just, you know, Friday nights or, you know, if they were a linear TV network, you know, Thursday nights at 7 p.m., but programming, you know, times of year when, you know, people maybe were more inclined to sit down and binge watch something. And I feel like that's kind of gone away. And I think that's interesting and says something about where we're at in this current moment in TV that, you know, Netflix in particular has changed a lot since they were, you know, making waves with those kinds of shows. Their original programming strategy has shifted. They're not investing in the same kinds of shows, The Queen's Gambit, you know, The Crown. You know, these are shows that were kind of greenlit in a different era. And if you look at what's coming, what's already started, I'm seeing a lot of holiday rom-coms, so many holiday rom-coms, so many. Which, you know, not a surprise. And those have been a you know, trademark of a Hallmark channel for a long time. But Netflix has really cornered the market in that space now as well. I don't know that I have a you know, super clear, concise thesis as to why that is. I do think one thing is we're coming off of COVID delays, strike-related delays,
right.
You know, things that maybe were initially earmarked for this time of year, maybe had to be pushed back or moved to a different, you know, window because of production challenges.
I love that you highlighted this because one of the things that we used to have was a very clearly defined sort of cycle of content where there was new content during the sweeps months and around them, and the summer was barren, and that's just how it was. And it's obviously completely changed. The TV season is year round now, and things are premiering at various times, and it doesn't matter. But I think you've identified something, which is it's not that there aren't seasons and there isn't a cycle, but it's different. And I think identifying that these downtime moments, the holidays, post-Thanksgiving, where there's more available viewing time in the, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, it's cold out. People are staying in, they're traveling or have family over. They're, you know, there's lots of holiday themed content out there. That's great. But it's also a time when other stuff can just pick up because people are talking about it, or it's an easy binge on Netflix or whatever it is. And I find that fascinating, right? That there's an idea that in the downtime of the holidays, in the downtime of right after like weekend of Thanksgiving, that there's an opportunity for a streamer to break something as a hit potentially because people have more time to watch, and that maybe that's the thing they've been meaning to watch, or that they're searching for something to watch because they've got that time now. And you know, I wonder if you're right that the strike and everything has sort of put everything off kilter, because sure, there are going to be rom-coms. There are going to be Hallmark movies and movies that are inspired by the Hallmark movie success. I get that. And those are great. And they're going to be holiday specials that happen. And those are great and fun. But I do wonder if I was a savvy streamer programmer, would I want to do exactly what you were describing, which is try to think, do I have something that I could drop and promote around this time of year that's not holiday themed, but is more like, this is going to be, it's the TV equivalent of a page turner. This is going to be something that people just want to binge. They're going to grab onto it. They've got the time. This is a good time for it. Because I remember that Making a Murder era where it was like, okay, I guess, I mean, it's like in the pandemic where everybody watched Tiger King, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, I got lots of time. Let's just watch it. And I wonder if maybe we will get back to that once the schedule is not completely, it feels like only now are we sort of like with the Diplomatic, a bunch of shows that have been gone for a suspiciously long amount of time are coming back, and it feels like it's because we're still shaking off the remains of the strike.
It's true. There is one other thing though that I think is at play now. You see a lot of this kind of show, the kind of prestige-y limited series or, you know, 8-episode drama, now all launching in the spring, in the kind of pre-Emmy eligibility window. The last few years, there's been this kind of crush of shows. It seemed like, you know, there was one couple week period where there were like 5 or 6 shows that were like all kind of Emmy contender shows that I wanted to watch that were all coming out at the same time. And I was like, I don't have enough hours in the day to watch all these shows. So I do wonder if some of that has shifted to kind of respond to, you know, the Emmy voting cycle. I mean, not Emmys have always been where they are, but, you know, as we've started to move away from this kind of fall TV season, you know, things have started to, you know, get pushed into the kind of spring corridor instead. So it's interesting to think about. I did highlight, pull up a couple of shows that are coming out in this time window that, you know, people can keep an eye on if they want to see if any of them become kind of the, you know, holiday, you know, water cooler show. On Netflix, they have A Man on the Inside, which just premiered. It's the new Mike Schur comedy starring Ted Danson as an undercover investigator at a retirement home. I've seen it. It's very fun. It's very heartwarming. It feels like a good Thanksgiving sit down with your parents kind of show. Netflix also has No Good Deed, which is this kind of interesting thriller comedy, and it stars Lisa Kudrow and Ray Romano as people trying to sell their house in Los Angeles. But there's perhaps a bit of a history with the house that will make it a hard sell. And then also Squid Game is returning on Netflix. So that's obviously a highly anticipated one. And then a couple others. Paramount Plus has The Agency, which is a remake of a French spy series called Le Bureau. I was a big fan of that show during the pandemic, so I'm excited to see how they do with this one. And then Disney has Star Wars Skeleton Crew, which, you know, it seems like they've always got something coming out in the Star Wars or Marvel world.
Of course.
But that's kind of it. I mean, maybe something will surprise us, but I'm feeling like there should be more in this window than there is.
Yeah, I agree. It's a good time. People have available time for watching. Now would be a good time to drop some more content. I agree. Those are good mentions of things people should look for too. Those all sound very interesting. I'm definitely. A Man on the Inside is definitely on my watch list, and Skeleton Crew looks intriguing because it's like the Goonies but Star Wars. Interesting. My feeling about a lot of those franchises, Marvel and Star Wars particularly, is I really like it when they try something different. I mean, maybe everybody else wants more of the same, but for me, it's like, you know, not everything has to be the same. You can do Star Wars, and it could be Andor. You could, you know, and maybe Skeleton Crew. You could do Marvel, and it can be like Agatha All Along, which I thought was a very successful Marvel show that was unlike other Marvel shows, but actually quite good. And the Deadpool and Wolverine movie is like that too, where it's like, it's not like every other Marvel movie. That's what makes it interesting. All right. Well, I will probably also have some extra time this holiday season, so I look forward to watching more TV, because that's what we do.
Absolutely.
All right. I wanted to do a little letter. I have one letter. People can send in their feedback. Downstreamfeedback.com is where you go for that. We love to hear from you. This one's a follow-up question about something I talked about last time about Taskmaster. Michael in the Plus 61 says, I love the idea of the Global Taskmaster YouTube channel, but I think it might be more of a US thing. In Australia, the YouTube channel only shows bits of the UK show, outtakes, interviews, occasional tasks. Full shows are hidden. There's no content from other countries at all. P.S. The New Zealand one is our favorite. Love to your mothers, Michael in the Plus 61. So I mentioned this. I think what's going on here, this is fascinating, because what it shows is that the Taskmaster strategy varies based on country to country and where their rights are. So it may be that the US experience is available only in countries where perhaps they don't have a rights holder, and that since there's an Australian Taskmaster and a New Zealand Taskmaster, maybe in those countries they see a very different thing. The larger point I was trying to make is that they seem to have given up trying to break Taskmaster in the US with a broadcast partner or a cable partner or a streaming partner, or even they attempted a US version that didn't really go anywhere. They tried on the CW to show the show, and that didn't go anywhere. And I think it got canceled after one episode. They just gave up. And they decided, you know, we can just put it on YouTube, and they can monetize it through either YouTube Premium or through ads. And so in a strange way, by them not having a partner that they were satisfied with in the US market, they just decided, we'll use YouTube. And it's kind of brilliant. It's kind of a great thing. So I appreciate Michael's letter. I love the Taskmaster YouTube channel in the US. I think that if you're a niche show in a different country, and there's no market for your program that you can find in America, you could do worse than putting it on YouTube in America and letting the people who, it's a big country, even a niche program could find a surprising audience in the United States if you put it somewhere where people can get to it. So
I will chime in, Jason, to say that I have no idea what Taskmaster is, and so I'm now eager to check it out. So clearly, you know, there's room for more audience.
It's a game show where comedians are asked to do stupid tasks, and then they're judged accordingly. And so it's a very, very funny game show sketch. It's unscripted. I guess a game show is the best description of it, but it sort of doesn't do it justice. There's some shows like it. I had somebody recommend a show that I can't remember now on Dropout that is a similar kind of premise. But it's delightful. And there are many seasons of it, the UK version, as well as, I agree with Michael as well, New Zealand version is excellent. The second season of New Zealand Taskmaster is really, really great. And all of them are good. Check it out.
I think this is a brilliant strategy. There's a show in Scotland that I really love called Scotland's Home of the Year, where three interior design architecture experts travel around and tour real people's homes and then rate them. And then at the end, someone wins for having a cool home. And it's so fascinating to just see them travel around to real people's houses and see different parts of the country. And during the pandemic, I found some episodes on YouTube and loved it. And I think there's more opportunity for these international shows to come to American audiences via YouTube and other platforms. I'm here for it.
Yeah, it's funny because just on our previous episode, one of the TV picks that Will Carroll had is Grand Designs Australia, which you also can't get in the United States, and that he loves, which is people designing houses in Australia, their dream houses. And he says it's amazing. And it's a version of a British show. Will asked last time as well, like, why can't we just watch the international survivors? And I kind of agree with that. Like, I don't understand in 2024 why. I understand if your show is on a streamer, if it's on, the Scotland show, if it's on Acorn or BritBox, I get it. But if it's nowhere, like, why wouldn't you try to find a way to make some money in other markets? Because I assure you, people in those markets are going to find your show. They're going to download it from the internet. They're going to do whatever they need to do to get it. Or maybe you could just put it on YouTube and make money from the ads. Maybe you could do that in those markets instead if you can't sell it. Because my dream back in the day of like in the future, the internet will connect everybody and all that would be that like if they made a TV show in Australia or Scotland, you could just watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real shame when they made it and nobody has it. So find a home for it.
Exactly.
I do love Acorn and BritBox. It's just, even they do not have all this stuff that I want to see. Like Taskmaster. Well, people should check out Taskmaster.
Peacock has been smart about this with the Traders and all the various international versions of the Traders. And they're really fun. The Australian version, excellent. Something about all those folks down under. I would watch Top Chef international episodes. I would watch Survivor international. Absolutely. Yeah.
Love Island. My daughter loves Love Island and watches the UK version on Hulu.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a US version, but there's also the UK version. It's like, yeah, do that. It's great. I love it. We watch Survivor with my daughter. Well, she doesn't live with us anymore, but we talk about it afterward. Like we text and we FaceTime and we talk about Survivor. And it's one of those things where you get to the end of the season in the spring or in the winter, and there's a 2 month gap or 3 month gap or 4 month gap between. It's like, you know, you could put that UK Survivor or that Australian Survivor on Paramount Plus, and fans of Survivor might have something to watch in the downtime. Seems like a good idea to me, but I don't know. I don't know why. It's very weird. All right. For our last segment, I have this new TV Picks thing where we want to talk about some stuff that, I mean, you already listed a bunch of stuff that's coming, which is great. Do you have any other TV picks for me about things people should check out?
I do. And this one I think is fun because it's kind of got a unique little, I don't know, it's a unique little mystery for people who want to know more about the media and rights and how all these things work. So it's a show called Rivals on Hulu and Disney Plus. It's an adaptation of a 1980s book series, and it stars David Tennant as a media baron who's building a cable channel in the Cotswolds. And, he has some competition for the business. And it's very fun. It's very over the top. There is a lot of adult content, I will warn people now. And that's kind of why it's interesting, because it's on Disney Plus. And I've heard a lot of people kind of go, huh, this isn't what I would have expected from Disney Plus. You know, when it first launched, it was this very family friendly brand. And, as best I can tell, you can also watch it on Hulu in the US. But as best as I can tell, it's a British show. And, Disney Plus around the world is a much more kind of full service, four quadrant streaming product. And, there's a fewer of those kind of delineations between the family friendly and the not. And so I think people are quite accustomed to seeing more adult content on Disney Plus in other countries. But it's a signal of the ways in which Bob Iger and the Disney team are certainly starting to evolve Disney Plus in the US as well. They're starting to now, you can see Hulu content on Disney Plus and vice versa. And, I think they are trying to, build it out into this much more full service streaming service. So Rivals, it's very fun. And it's a good, easy watch probably while you're, full of turkey in the coming days.
I love it. I know when Disney Plus debuted and we had all the conversations about Hulu and adult content and could the Disney brand handle it. And of course overseas the Disney brand, Disney Plus didn't, there was no Hulu. Disney Plus just had it already. But here in the US, we wrung our hands about it. And I was thinking about this as I was watching Deadpool and Wolverine, a Marvel movie on Disney Plus that's rated R.
Mm-hmm.
And also when I watch Hulu content in there, which I moved all my Hulu stuff in there as well. So we're watching, What We Do in the Shadows in there. We're watching all the FX stuff in there. That it's fine. It turns out the Disney brand can expand and it's okay. It's like I'm getting over it now. I think that they've got parental controls and they've got adult content and stuff for kids, and it's okay. It's okay. Not everything has to be just good enough for kids. Disney can reach beyond. It's fine. So that's a cool. I'm going to give a boring. I mean, it's just more an old school thing that I'm going to pick this time. John Hughes made a lot of really endearing movies in the 80s. He made Home Alone, which is the one that people are most familiar with, probably. But so many great iconic 80s movies. Home Alone, a Christmas movie, right? Too. So you might be thinking, oh, 'tis the season. But he also made in 1987 perhaps the greatest Thanksgiving movie ever, and it's available on Paramount Plus right now. So just putting in another plug, since it is Thanksgiving week, for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which stars Steve Martin and John Candy as two mismatched travelers who are stuck together as they try to get back to Chicago when their plane is rerouted to Kansas, I want to say. And they have a succession, like, you know, it's, I mean, I realized when we did a podcast about this last month on, or earlier this month for The Incomparable, where I realized halfway through that it literally is the Odyssey. It is, he's just trying to get home to his wife. And every episode of this movie, something else goes wrong. And that's the whole thing. And it's funny and it's touching. And I don't know whether people who are not my age even remember this movie, but it is a certifiable Thanksgiving classic, and it's on Paramount Plus. So, and it's, I believe, on Pluto with ads, because that makes sense because it's Paramount. So check it out. It's a good holiday movie that's not a Christmas movie, and maybe you haven't seen it a million times. And even post Thanksgiving, it's set at Thanksgiving, but it's like, it's a good one. People should check it out. I really like it.
That's a really good pick. I love it.
That's a good John Candy, you know, left us too soon, but he is a treasure. And Steve Martin, you know, speaking of those movie stars who just do TV shows now, it's not just Meryl Streep on that show. Yeah. It's just Steve Martin's there.
You're
just,
absolutely right.
He's just got a TV show now. I guess that's it. Natalie, it has been so great talking to you again. I hope you'll come back some other time and we can do this again.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Where can people find you in the wilds of the internet these days?
I'm writing for a lot of different outlets, and I, you know, try to promote all my stories on various social media sites. I'm on them all, it seems, these days. There's many to be on, and I'm at Nat Jarve on all platforms.
Excellent. Nat Jarve. People should check it out. If you haven't yet, please consider subscribing to Downstream Plus. This was a full-sized episode for everyone, but the only way to hear the complete version of our next episode is to subscribe. Got some nice guests coming up in December. Go to downstream.plus to subscribe and support the show. You can find me over at sixcolors.com, and I appear on many other podcasts here at Relay and over at theincomparable.com. Thanks to everybody for listening. If you celebrate Thanksgiving, happy Thanksgiving to all of you. And if you don't, happy a week with a Thursday in it to the rest of you. We'll see you next time.